again, as an 18, 19 year old, and going to the library and renting these cassette tapes for, you know, mentors and life skills people and people who talked about business, it was always this idea, you know, that you had to balance life, and that there was this idea that you could actually work-life balance, right? Or have freedom in your business. And as soon as I got into the business, I realized right away, like, that's a crock of crap. Like, there's no such thing as work-life balance, and there's no such thing as freedom in a business. So I was actually kind of, it frustrated me, because I think when people aren't balancing, they feel like they're doing something wrong, right? So
what if story is the answer to our crises of meaning and belonging, to our impulse to heal our lives and help others, to our desire and drive to leave this world better than we found it? Now, we love good stories. In fact, we're kind of obsessed, not just with the stories themselves, but with the stories behind the stories. Their oddly perfect timing, the healing process they provoke in their authors, and their capacity to catalyze individual and collective change. And we love exploring these with writers, thought leaders, entrepreneurs, healers, parents, and others. Tune in to hear these stories behind the stories and entertain with us the real possibility that whether you are a teller or a consumer, story is always offering or leading us to an answer. Stephanie Kemp opened her first business and married her high school sweetheart right out of college, and she became a millionaire before she was 30. But what's uniquely impressive about Stephanie is that she has sustained whole life success for 3 decades. Today, you get to hear some of her secrets to sustained success. Today, we talked about how she set her business and her children up for radical success with the concept of the urn, and how she rewrote her family narrative around work and wealth and created a healthy, empowering culture for her business. Plus, and maybe this was my favorite part, she talks about her alternative to work-life balance, which enabled her to write a manuscript in 2 months while running 4 businesses. Just saying, you're going to enjoy it today. Grab something yummy to sip on and enjoy these timeless lessons that will help you achieve and sustain success. All right. Welcome to Sips of Story and Sanity, where we talk about the stories behind the stories with authors and speakers and thought leaders and amazing entrepreneurs like the one we have here today. A few of my partners here at Saved by Story are here with me to get the yummiest, delicious sips of story and sanity out of this experience. Hi, Teddy. You want to say hello?
Hi, y'all.
And hi, Lori. Thanks.
Hey, everyone. It's good to be here.
Yeah, it's going to be such a good day. So we're all really excited because we have Stephanie with us. Stephanie Kemp is an award-winning choreographer, teacher, mentor, author, and no-nonsense CEO. A self-proclaimed business junkie, her obsession with the service industry catapulted her early success from startup to scale up, proving service, great service, is relationship-driven. She believes it is the responsibility of mentors, coaches, and business owners alike to help everyone in their organization see past limitations, set high expectations, and earn their worth. A serial entrepreneur, she has used her time-tested techniques, strategies, and lessons to not only sustain her 7- and 8-figure businesses, but to endure and thrive over 3 decades. And she's the soon-to-be author of Success is Just the Beginning, 6 Timeless Lessons to Achieve More in Business, Love, and Legacy. So, I mean, my first question for people who have bios like this is, like, how much do you actually sleep, or do you?
Not too much, actually. Not because of the work, just because I'm an overthinker. So I tend to wake up a lot in the middle of the night with ideas. And I have a notebook by the bed, which I started about 15 years ago, which definitely helps. Because when it's not there, I can write an entire story or choreograph an entire routine and then wake up in the next day and have absolutely no idea. One sentence or one move that I choreographed. So the notebook by my bed is great, but I've always been a night owl. So it was difficult when the kids were little because I was one who could be up 2-3 in the morning, and then, you know, getting up with them in the morning, I kind of changed my habits a little bit. So not too much sleep, but I guess just enough. I never feel tired. I wake up ready to go. So I guess I get just enough sleep.
Yeah. I mean, really, you know, as I've watched you wrote this book and I think the first manuscript was under 2 months. And so, you know, knowing this part of your bio, seeing the things at a high level of what you do, we're going to talk more about time later today because you have a whole section in the book on this. And I feel like if there's one of those things that's like, what's the first thing that an entrepreneur is probably thinking, how do I create more time in my life? And I think you figured this out. So I'm excited to get there. But, you know, when we first met, a friend connected us, and he always sends me the best people. Like, I love the people. In fact, Lori came from Phil too. And he always sends me great people. And I just love getting to know some of the folks. And I loved our first meeting. I loved hearing about everything that you had accomplished with the dance. And two things really struck me. The first one was, you know, being at a place, at the place in the business where I'm at, where it's, I'm just now creating a second business, right, with partners. And so I am in that weird, okay, so there's the strange little bit of ownership conversation, but there's the real conversation around time and building team and delegation, all the things I didn't have to think about while I was just me doing that. And, you know, that whole part is really my own edge. But the thing that I have been saying, and Teddy will testify to this, for the last 10 years, really, is that all I did was watch one mentor after another sacrifice some part of their life because it was just the moment to push forward their business. You know, it was just, I'm just going to do this now. I'm just going to leave my kid at home for weeks at a time or whatever the thing was that they would make the case for. And I watched how those decisions didn't stop with just the one. It turned into a way of life that they almost felt like they didn't have a way out of because they'd created something and had to do whatever it took to sustain it. And yet they lost some of the most precious parts of their lives. So when I heard you tell your story, I was just like, oh my gosh, I can't wait to work on this book and learn from this lady as I go. And then the second piece was about this everybody gets a trophy generation. So I'm going to have you talk about that because I really want to hear. To me, it's one of those... could be kind of a touchy, controversial topic. And we talked about that up at the front of this, of like, how do we come at this so that people really understand where your heart is with this? So I would love for you to kind of start there.
Okay, sure. Hi, everybody. Thank you for having me. So I started a dance studio over 34 years ago. And competition wasn't really that big when I started the dance studio. So everybody really had an amazing work ethic. Kids came in, parents paid for lessons. And the idea was that they would earn their placements wherever that was, in a class, in teamwork. And if they were rewarded for time or for accomplishments, they were always things that they earned. And as the years went on, people would start telling me how kids have changed. And the reality is that kids have not changed, right? But how we treat kids has changed. Mm-hmm. And so as more dance studios started opening and the level of what was expected in dance studios was not really mandated because it's really not like a standard to excellence. It became a marketing ploy for not just dance, of course, but for any business that you shouldn't have to work that hard. And, you know, we want children to enjoy their sports and enjoy basketball and enjoy dance and enjoy music. And it shouldn't really be something that we leverage or hold over their head, this idea of like championship or trophy. So let's let everybody kind of come in, work at their own pace, have their own time commitment, and everybody will then still win the same thing at the end. And I often relate this to no different that if at a big event, if you were at the World Series or you were at the Super Bowl, instead of actually playing the game, if they just flipped a coin and the winner then got the same trophy and the same accolade and the same banner and the same prize money, would everybody be just as excited in the stands? Or would the players spend their whole life working for something that at the end, if it had the exact same outcome, it would be the same trophy, it would be the same accolades, but we would have missed the earn. The athletes get up every day, not really for the win, but for the earned win. And I think when we talk to children and we are educators or we're in a space where we work with children, we learn really early on, they actually work for the earned win as well. But if we tell them early, they don't have to earn it, then they'll be just as happy with the ribbon or the trophy. And they won't have learned the lessons. So although it was something that I used in the dance space, I found it was moving over into all aspects of kids' lives. When we start leveling them, then they start learning that, well, it doesn't really matter what level I'm in, right at the end, I'll get the same reward as anyone else. So I was always very careful in my businesses to make sure that everybody was always earning their way. So that there was never this idea that you could kind of come in and take the road of least resistance and end up on the same level as someone else that was putting in like all the sweat equity. And in 2020, when the pandemic hit, I was in a lot of meetings with business owners. And the number one complaint was that these kids, you know, people weren't showing up to work and employees were calling in and nobody had resolve and nobody had resilience. And my number one thing to everyone is, well, why would they, right? Why would they have resolve and resistance? You've been telling them for the last 15 years, they don't have to get up. They don't have to persevere, that they'll have the same reward, whether they show up or they don't show up. So I just thought we're in a really pivotal time right now. And so I'm going down with this idea, taking it with me that no matter any child on my watch, any employee on my watch, I believe in equality, but mostly I believe in equity. And equity means that people get what they earn. And life is not always fair, and life is not always even. And I would rather they learn those lessons when they're young and they're in a safe space where they can learn how to get the tools to kind of overcome when they get disappointed, than learn those lessons when they're adults.
Yep. That's it. That was the thing I fell in love with, because when I was early on with Aaron, I was so committed to these high expectations. And, you know, I took a lot of flack for it because I asked so much of him. I mean, I don't know, Teddy, if you remember, if you were there, but one of my clients actually chastised me for teaching him how to make his own lunch at like 5 or 6. And I was thinking, but he just learned how to put together a basic meal with like all the nutrition he needed. And I just got 10 minutes of my life every day back. He needs that skill. You know, it was one of these things, but they were just, you know, no, we should just nurture and take care of. And then, you know, they get to be 18 years old and I hear my kids still can't make a sandwich, you know, and I'm like, well, remember when you were so hard on me?
Right.
But it's that same sort of thing as, you know, all of these moments where you have the opportunity to set the bar high, and how kids especially, I mean, I think it's a little bit harder with adults because they've been worn down so much. There's like a rebuild that has to happen. Man, when you set those standards high, don't you find that kids are just like so eager to meet them?
Well, certainly. And I think we're born with that, right? And I talk about that a little bit. I think we're born. We don't know how to crawl. We don't know how to walk. We don't know how to pull up. We don't know how to do so many things. And we, every time we fall down, we get back up. As little kids, we'll just keep pulling up and pulling up and pulling up until somebody just keeps picking us up. We will continue to pull ourselves up. So I just like, you know, I always had a kind of a tougher exterior with my own two kids. And I think it's a fine line. I mean, I absolutely adore my children and I love them and cuddle them to death. I mean, they're all grown up now, but I let them fall. I let them fall. And I always said, you know, would kind of watch them get back up. And they did. And I had a crazy one that was flipping all over the house. And she always had me like a nervous wreck. And she would sometimes kaplot. And then she would say, well, I guess I can't fall from that height anymore, right? Without like knocking myself out. So there, I would get criticized for that too, right? Because I did kind of oversee them. I tried not to coddle them too much. I never, ever helped with a homework project. Mm-hmm. I mean, my kids went to these pretty like elite private schools where, you know, 17 people would help like on a project. And my kids would have like what a sixth grade project looks like. And they would learn from that experience. And they would, you know, sometimes they'd come home and they'd tell me these like unbelievable, you know, windmills that you turn on and they're actually like really working. And my daughter would be like, Mom, I have like, you know, CVS poster board. I'm like, well, that's what a sixth grader's project looks like, Sierra. So you got to just, you know, work a little harder if you want it to be better. But I mean, I didn't quiz them. And they both went off to school and sailed, where I have friends whose kids really struggled, you know, in school, in the upper grades, because there was so much support. And again, I'm not saying not to support your children, right? And I'm not saying that we don't pick them up when they fall or love them. I'm just saying that I think if we do too much too soon and they don't have any tools to learn how to pick themselves up when they have disappointments, or challenges, I just think we are in trouble with the generation as they get older. So really, that's my main message, is that, you know, I think I'm successful because I worked for it. And I wouldn't trade 1 ounce of that. And I wouldn't want to change anything for my kids. And even though we had more resources, I always made it very clear that like, Daddy and I have resources, but like you two, you got nothing. You got to work for everything you have.
Yeah. Yeah. I've seen the flip side of that narrative and it is not pretty. It is not pretty at all. So, so that's, and you brought up another point that was kind of something that we had to really talk through and kind of massage as we were working through the manuscript. And that is this piece of, resources and time and the amount of support that you have and all of these things that, you know, one of the, as we were working through what could possibly be some of the objections, right? Of this being like, gee, Steph, it's kind of a charm life you're living, you know? And you're like, no. We have to cut that off at the beginning. So I'd love for you to speak to that a little bit about that, the earning piece, but also about where you came from, you know, where you've built from, let's say.
Well, certainly I would be the first to say I have had a charmed life. Absolutely. I am grateful for it. I think the difference is that I just didn't wake up, though, in those shoes. And like my children had a way better start, right, than I did. But again, I try not to have them rest on those laurels. They have to go out and pave their own way in the world. And I had two unbelievably loving parents. And I do joke, you know, they taught me how to be poor, but we weren't poor, right? I mean, we lived in a very shabby house on the highway. I definitely like didn't bring kids and friends home to my house. I always went to their house, but I had an unbelievably loving childhood. But my parents taught me, you know, how to remortgage and mortgage and how to get car loans and how to, you know, borrow from Peter to pay Paul and how to work 17-hour weeks and 15-hour days with nothing at the end of the month. And it wasn't their fault. It's just what they knew. And I taught my kids English, right? Because it's the only language I knew. And I knew maybe French and Chinese would propel them better in life, but I was limited, right? I only knew English. And my parents were limited and they taught me what they knew. they hadn't, nobody in either side went to college. They couldn't wait for me to go to college. I think they thought, you know, I was going to just change the whole family tree with a college education. And of course, what it did is it just opened my world. Because when you're younger and you have a small circle of people that are teaching you, your world is so small. And I think back to those days of, you know, there was just so much I didn't know. And what was great about college is that I fell into like the same trap, and I had four jobs, and I was paying Peter to pay Paul, and I had a car that I bought for $300, and I was getting the insurance. I'm trying to help pay college bills and, you know, skipping down to one meal. And I just thought, like, I don't want this. There has to be a better way. And so for me, the library really became my education. What I love most about college is that it opened me up to like the business books that were in the library, and they became my real teacher. And I realized that, you know, wealthy people are not smarter or more talented. They just have the knowledge. They just have the information that we don't have. So as soon as I got that information, I was able to really kind of change my family tree. And I was lucky because I always wanted to be an entrepreneur, and my parents were entrepreneurs, but I could learn from their mistakes. And when you talked a little bit about the team and time management, you said we'll get to that later. But I knew at 18 that I wanted to open a business. So I was so lucky that I didn't yet have the family and the children. So I could really kind of delve into that time to build the business before I could really set my calendar or give myself back the time that I knew the only way that I would go into being an entrepreneur is if I had options. Otherwise, I didn't want to just own a job like my parents had. So I was lucky that at a young age, I knew kind of exactly the path I wanted. And again, that came from reading, that came from books, and that came from just really throwing myself into, instead of algebra or calculus in college, you know, I was learning about dollar cost averaging and saving for my retirement. And that really became like my education.
So you're surrounded by books and learning from them. Did it ever occur to you that you would write one someday?
Definitely not. I mean, I do say too in the book, you know, I flunked out of ninth grade. I went to summer school. I mean, to think that I would write a book that anyone would care 1 ounce of what I had to say, I would never even have entertained it. And even if you asked me last year at this time, I would say absolutely not. No desire. I'm not a strong math student, and the only thing I'm equally as awful at is spelling. So, you know, punctuation and spelling, and so no. And I had joined a mastermind group, and we had these really small round tables every month, and everyone would kind of throw out their business conflict or something they were struggling with, and they'd go around, and everyone kind of would have similar advice. And I always seemed like I was taking just the complete opposite approach. And I would say, oh, I would think I would do this in that circumstance. And at the end of every call, someone on the round table would say, you know, Stephanie, you should write a book. And I would say, no, God, no. And then at the next month, I would say something and someone would say, hey, you know, I quoted you last month, or I'm using what you said last month. And then I was going into a new business venture and someone mentioned, hey, have you ever thought of writing a book? And I thought, absolutely not. Yeah. I went to vacation and was reading a book. Again, I took a suitcase 3 weeks every year, Christmas time to New Year's. My family, we go away for 3 weeks, and I do my entire like plan for the next year. And I have one suitcase always dedicated, all nonfiction books. And I've had it forever. My husband knows, one extra suitcase is always going with us. And there's all the books for the entire year that I wanted to read that I didn't have time, all go in this suitcase. And I read them all over that 3 week period. And I was reading a book and something in there sparked me, and I put it down and I thought, would I ever consider writing a book? And then I went, no, I would never want to. The next day I wake up and I have an invitation to a speaking engagement that I couldn't get to. And it was Lisa Nichols, who I had seen once before, like a year ago. And I thought, do I want to watch this? I was sitting in front of the computer and I put it on. And she's so engaging, and I was just really mesmerized. And right at the end, I felt like she looked right at me and she said, if not now, when? And if not you, who? And I turned it off and I said, well, I guess I'm writing a book.
Yeah. And what's really fun is the connection that happened once we spoke, right?
So crazy.
Because I met Phil through Ursula, and Ursula is the one that I went to and said, "So I have this insane idea. I want to attract a secret teacher." And she was like, "That's not insane. How soon do you want to do it?"
Right.
And then met Lisa a few. So it was just a funny little like, "Oh, this is the
The
suit
whole
that."
circle, right? Because Phil was the one always pushing me the whole time, saying, "You should write a book. You should write a book. You should do a podcast." Because he loved the Boston accent, which I didn't like. He was like, "I want to hear you talk more. I want to hear you talk more. You got to get on a podcast." So when I texted him, I said, "Phil, I think I might do it 2023. I think I might write the book." He said, "I got the perfect person I want you to talk to." And we connected right away. And then later on, after we made that connection, on the next call, or I read in your bio or something, I connected that you had this relationship with Lisa Nichols, and I just got like the goosebumps thinking like, ah! That's crazy.
Yeah, it made me smile when I was looking at the acknowledgments at the end of your
Right.
book.
It's like boom, boom, boom,
Oh,
right?
Lisa, Amanda. Okay, cool. So, oh my gosh, I always find it fascinating. Like some people, they have this knowing that they're going to write a book from the time that they're very, very young, but they don't know what they're going to write about. And then some people know what they would write about, but they never have a desire or inkling to do it, and they have to be kind of nudged or shoved in that direction to even consider it. So, but like you said, you know, the entrepreneur thing, like that seems like it was in your DNA. It was in your core. I mean, really, how early were you an entrepreneur? Were you doing
Early,
as a
early. Oh
kid?
yeah. It's funny because my brother, who was one of the beta readers, said that he's like, 7 years old, you were opening up the door and doing, preschool dance lessons in the basement. I made apple pies. I had an apple pie business in the 7th grade where every weekend I sold apple pies for 6 months leading up until Thanksgiving. I talked my parents into selling Christmas trees, and they let me sell Christmas trees. I had a shovel on the shoulder, and every snowstorm, I just went up and down like every neighborhood, seeing if anyone needed any help getting shoveled out. So any opportunity to kind of start my own business from as far back as I can remember, I was doing it.
Love that. Love it. So you love dance. You knew you wanted to build a business. Dance studio makes sense to be the first business. Yeah.
So I do talk. I love startup companies, and I often talk to people who are starting up. And one thing I do always try to kind of caution them on is, I mean, starting a business, I think you need a skill, and I think you need interest to refine that skill. But I would be a little leery of too much passion in the beginning. So I would say that I was really good at the dance, which is why it seemed like that would be a non-starter. That would be just like make sense for opening the dance studio. But the passion came later for me. I was probably more passionate about acting when I was in school, but the dance was just easier. It fit into the schedule better. And I had a really great kind of mind for choreography. So that was something I knew I could do better than most anyone else. So having a high skill set, really kind of being strong in the choreography, lend itself to that first business being dance. But number one, I think an entrepreneur should just have the skills and the interest to get better, but not necessarily that it needs to be like this big, big passion in the beginning. I think the passion will come.
So you said I'm wary of it when it's too passionate, and that's what
I
I
am
learned
wary
about.
of it. Yeah, because the only business, so I've started like 10 companies as an adult. The only business that went down in flames was the only one that I was the most passionate about, because I didn't have the skill set, and it was the only product-based business, and I didn't do the due diligence, and most importantly, it was the only business I had money, and which is funny because on the other ones I was so conservative, and I never made uncalculated risk jumps. I'm not a gambler, so I was very, sure. And the first business was the capital for all the other businesses. So I never like leveraged anything. I was always very, very, you know, save first and then open this business, work hard and then open this business. And I just became so passionate about, I started living like a plant-free diet life and not wanting any chemicals or any preservatives in anything. And when I had all these students at the dance studio using hairspray and lipsticks, I thought, well, I have the next best business in the world. I'm going to be the next Maybelline and I'm going to create all these products for kids and dancers that have like no chemicals. So all natural organic hairsprays and hair gels and lipsticks and dancewear made out of all organic material, organic cotton, organic bamboo. And I just went head first, all passion, no skill set. And I ended up selling the company because of I had the inventory, but it was the only business that was all passion first and not like any of the background that I knew intellectually I needed to create a strong business. Mm.
Yeah. It's really interesting to hear you say that. It is about that balance, right? You don't really, it's hard to stay in something for a long time if you don't really care about it. But if you don't have the skill set, and also I'm curious with you because, you know, running, hauling ass alongside you for 2 months while you're writing this book, right? How fast you move. How much of this do you think is nature? Because, you know, the book is about developing skill, developing mindset, developing those things. But do you ever look at some people and think, yeah, you're just not an entrepreneur. Like you just don't have that thing. Do you ever think that?
I don't think they don't have that thing. But what I think is they take themselves with them, right? So when we want to open a business, we take ourselves to that business, even though it's not necessarily has our name on it, could be anything. So I never count anyone out. I think anybody can learn and grow. But when you got a bunch going on in your own life, you can't separate that originally in a business. And I think you have to be very clear as to why you are opening the business. If you are going into customer service and you're not someone who's emotionally kind of regulated, you can struggle when you're working with people. If you are someone who, you know, thinks your way is the highway and you can't really like listen to someone else's side, or you have convictions that won't like kind of allow you to open up your mind and thought, you know, then you're taking that with you into the business. So it's not that I think that someone can or can't be strong as an entrepreneur, but I think they have to be very clear as to the person that's going to be, you know, taking that business over. And in that regard, I don't think everybody is ready to be an entrepreneur because they just haven't figured their crap out.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
More so than like the kind of person that could potentially, because I think someone could have amazing ideas, right? And they could be incredibly talented, but it's more than that, right? To be an entrepreneur, it's more than that to be the leader of a business. So I think if they could work that stuff out, and then I think anybody could be an entrepreneur, but most of the time, you know, we sabotage ourselves.
Yeah. I wonder if that comes back to the way that we get spoken to when we're little ones. You know, it's kind of like when Aaron said, you know, I'm not really interested in college. I wasn't surprised because he, you know, it was a different reaction from me, him saying, I want to start my own business than when I told my parents I was starting my own business, right? Because they had this particular way and I was breaking the mold. But him, you know, he was kicking my butt at Monopoly when he was 4 and running some sort of racket at our garage sales and making a ton of money. Like, I just knew that that was going to be his path. So I kind of wonder how much of it is that thing that you're talking about, the talking to children without the high expectations, without the you know, asking them to critically think and look for problems to solve, and, you know, those types of things, right. Like all those things that entrepreneurs tend to be pretty good at.
Yeah. Yeah, I think so. I think my parents, they didn't know how to get me there, right? They didn't necessarily know how to help me achieve it, but they knew there was a better world out there. And they certainly told me from a very young age, and what I believe to be true of myself when I was young, that, You know, there was absolutely nothing that I couldn't tackle. And my mother is a little more mushy. You know, my mother is the one who would kind of want to coddle probably a little bit more. When my father was the more realist, and I think I take after my father more. That's the biggest criticism that I have of myself is that I tend to be such a realist to the point where it can be off-putting. And I know that we've talked about that as far as, like we were saying, the tenor of the book. But when my daughter got in kindergarten, now she could tend to be a little bit more dramatic. So I was quick to kind of not ever play into that. But I remember her getting into the backseat of the car in kindergarten, and she was really upset. And she said that everybody in the class had got invited to this birthday party, and Kara got invited, and Joey got invited, like all of her friends, and that she wasn't invited. And she said, you know, Missy didn't invite me. And I said, Missy doesn't think of you as a friend, honey. She doesn't like you like that. And you have a lot of other friends, and you'll have a lot of other birthday parties. So, you know, I had a girlfriend that was like, oh, like, how could you say that to your little six-year-old in the back seat? And I just, it didn't ever dawn on me that I was hurting her feelings more. It was more so that, like, that's the reality. So we just deal with, this is what we're dealt today. And now how do we make you feel better? We say that, correct, you were not invited to this birthday party. She doesn't think of you as a friend. You've never mentioned her to me before this day, so you don't think of her as a friend either, but you have a lot of other friends and you will have a lot of other birthday parties. And let's go on to something else. So I have a girlfriend that would have, you know, taken her daughter out for a manicure and just been devastated and wanted to call the mom, like, how can you leave one child out? Like, I never felt like that. And I had disappointments when I grew up, and my dad would say, you know, kind of the real story. And I like appreciated it. I appreciated realism. You know, my mother would say, you're the most talented. You're the most beautiful. You can do anything you want. You're the smartest. And my father would say, yeah, you're not so smart, but you're cute. You know, I mean, my father was kind of like more the realist, and I just kind of took more to that. I'm like the Band-Aid off kind of person. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, and I think it just helps us get out of our own way. I'd rather not sugarcoat it. I'd rather just be honest so that we can, if we have to solve a problem, let's solve it. Let's get what we need so that we are informed. I just think we make life so much harder sometimes. It doesn't have to be so dramatic. There's not always just a black and white. There's so much gray. So let's figure out how we can move forward and not get pulled back into like the drama of life. Because I'm so anti that. And it's funny that I chose a business where it's known to be so dramatic. And yet 34 years later, that's probably the number one thing people would say is that how undramatic my dance studio is. You know, we we work hard, we play hard, but we're just not sitting around. You know, there's just no value, there's zero value in complaining. So we just don't do it.
So I want to talk about that. What were some of those early decisions that you made in the business that you feel like made that difference, that you created a culture inside of an industry that is kind of unseen before you?
Yeah. So I grew up in the dance studio world. So I was in the dance studio my whole life. And then when I went to college, I spent 4 years teaching at different dance studios. And I couldn't believe as I got older how strong the culture was, but yet how unhealthy in a lot of ways it was. And because it was one of four jobs, I worked in the service industry and four other jobs, I was always really able to compare how different the dance studio industry was as far as, you know, the dictatorship, really. It's my way or the highway. Students were not really giving any choices in schedules, and there was such a strong loyalty kind of umbrella that if you looked at another teacher, if you talked to a student that didn't dance where you were, if you got classes somewhere else, then you were just like the traitor. And there would be this almost this idea that everyone should kind of rally against that person, which I thought was crazy. And we're talking about kids, and kids can't make these decisions. You know, when a grown-up is telling like a student who's like 14 or 15, treating them almost like you're talking to a peer, it seemed just, you know, out of character for what I would think a mentor or a teacher should be. So when I opened my business, I just knew that so many things that I grew up in the dance world, like I wanted to change it. I wanted kids to have a life outside of dance and yet still have the top quality classes. Because when I was growing up, I was, you know, in the theater, I was captain of the cheerleading, I was president of my class. This was before, you know, I went to high school. And it was like, they always wanted me to give up everything, you know, give up everything to dance. And I didn't want to. So if I wanted to dance in these high level classes, I had to give up things. And if I didn't give up things, they wanted to always kind of push me down this other path, which I thought was not fair. And so I was a major juggler. And I gave up things that I didn't feel like I should have to give up. And I certainly didn't want that to be for any student that I had. I also went into this as a business. And the reality is, as a business, I felt like in the restaurant business or in other service industries, you know, I work for you. And if you're 4 years old, you're my client, just like your parents, my client. And I want to do what is in your best interest, because I'm here to serve it, to serve you. And that was so opposite the idea of the dance industry, even though it's supposed to be in the service industry. There was no service in the service industry and dance. And so I wanted to bring that kind of forefront when I opened a business. And, you know, it scaled so fast, and it just proved right away that it was really something that was so needed.
Yeah. Imagine a dance studio where it wasn't about service.
Yeah, it was out there. It was out there, but not for me. Mm-hmm.
Okay, so now I want to talk about time, because this time thing, this time business with you is like, you know, like I said, how much do you sleep at night? How do you get more hours in your day? These are all the questions that anyone who knows you is probably asking all the time. So you have a chapter in the book called Time and Trouble. And there's this image that you used about understanding time and balance, and you related it to dance. I'd love for you to share that today and just kind of help us to understand how someone who juggles as many balls as you do in one day writes a book in 2 months. Go.
Yes. So, I do have to preface, I think, by saying, and I know that this is different for everybody, but I do like to always remind people too, when they hear my story, that I started young. So again, I wasn't 35 with 5 children and then saying, well, you know, I want to open a business and I want my calendar to be mine and I want to have the options and I don't want to do anything that I don't want to do. I knew from the age of 18 what I wanted to do. So it was much easier to navigate. I also, one of the very first books that I read was The E-Myth, which is the McDonald's story, which talks a lot about working on your business and not in your business. And I disagreed with so much of that book, which is, you know, really controversial, because I totally thought you can't be successful. And I still say this today, as controversial as it is, you cannot be successful in any business if you're not the expert of your business. And I don't believe any employee should ever be hand the reins to any business until you know exactly what the culture and the brand is. So I was married, but I had no children. And I was able to spend the first 3 years really building the brand before and the culture before I ever handed the reins to someone else. And so I knew exactly what the business smelled like. I knew what it tasted like. I knew exactly who I wanted to bring in. And I knew exactly how I would then lead them. And in every business since then, you know, we don't bring in another person in until one, it can support it financially, because financial independence was very important to me. And I wasn't going to pay someone else before I was paying myself first. And then also to really know what the culture feels like before we start inviting people. Almost like I feel like a dinner party. Like you wouldn't invite people to your house to have dinner if you didn't have enough food in the refrigerator to feed everybody. So I'm not inviting employees until I can open my refrigerator and say, I want you to eat as much as you want, you know, and I want you to really feel like, you know, you are supported here. So once I was really feel like I had my footing in the business, is when I said, you know, to my husband, okay, I'm ready, like, to start planning a family. I'm ready to, like, bring people in. So that has really served me well because I was prepared before I started a family to know exactly what I wanted my life and my schedule to look like. Because my husband and I, you know, we grew up together. So if I was going to work 6 days a week in the business, like he could fend for himself. But I wanted to be a stay-at-home mom, and I did not want to have children and then have anyone else raise them. So I knew that if I was going to have a business that was going to still support me and I was going to still be able to be the CEO and thrive as a CEO, I needed to have options and I needed to have opportunities for myself to be able to do both. So I didn't open up the thought of even having children until I knew that I was really kind of steady on my own two feet, which a lot of entrepreneurs, again, can't do, right? Because they're coming into it later in the game. So from 14, I had a notebook where I was already planning out, like at 18, at 19, at 20, when I opened the doors, you know, when I would like have this amount of money in the bank, when I would have my first employee. So it was very planned for me. And I was also very careful on who I brought in. I think our biggest role as CEO is hiring, right? Just like almost like a babysitter in your business. You wouldn't give your precious babies to like just anyone. And I feel like the same way in a business. And so I was really very strategic in hiring. And I really needed really strong thinkers because I knew that as soon as I brought someone in, I would not be babysitting them. And I get paid, I would always say, a lot of money to teach people how to dance. So if I brought an employee in, I wasn't going to pay them to teach them. I wanted someone that already came to me with a skill set and then I could just help lead them. So that really helped me manage my time. So when I had my first Lamaze class, and I tell the story in the book, I took that Wednesday, it was my first day off. The teacher, I hired a teacher for Wednesdays, and every single Wednesday she came, I never went to the studio, not one day. And that was my very first hire. It was my first weekly day off. I didn't make it to one Wednesday. And I remember on her first day, she said, I'll call you if the place burns down. And I said, don't call me, call the fire department because I will not know what to do. And I do say, so instead of having to put out the little fires in my business, I just relied on people, paid them well to do the service that I believed in them that they could do. Because I really thought if I can do it, then someone else who has a high skill set can do it too. So I'm not a micromanager, I'm not a perfectionist. And that has been able to lead me to live a calendar and a schedule that I feel like, you know, I could live with. Also, you know, I'm just not, again, in the realist thing, I just don't suffer from FOMO ever. So when I had friends who were doing things or planning things, you know, a no to a lot of things were always a yes to myself. And so I never felt like pressure to do things. Now, sometimes, you know, on a Memorial Day weekend, I went to a baby shower, not because I wanted to go, but because the relationship was the yes, right? Maybe the event wasn't, but the relationship was. But I always kind of picked and choosed my calendar and my time on my timetable. And so because I was able to do it from the beginning, I think that's why I was successful at it, I think.
Yeah. Yeah, it is tricky. I remember I had one of my very first coaches, Ursula. She was telling me about all these different ways that I could market the business. And I remember listening to her share about what her days look like and thinking, nope, I have a little kid at home. And I have an ailing grandma, and I shot that right back at her. And I was like, that's amazing that that's worked for you, but I need something else because this is the amount of time. And the idea that came out of that session propelled my business forward in like so fast because it was that, like, that's just not going to work. It had to work inside the timepiece. But, yeah, it's hard to do it when you're older and you have all of those pieces together. But I do think that those habits that you talk about, you know, the leaving your phone in the car and, you know, really the idea, and I understand this to a degree because there are certain phases of a project that I can't do in a multitask sort of way. I can't even include it in a day when I'm doing a lot of admin or I'm doing a lot of coaching. I have to block like half days for either working on one of my books or working on someone else's book. And so I understand that, like the gift, how time stretches when you say, no, you know, nothing, sign on the door. Don't even think about disrupting me unless, right. You know, blood or fire. That's what I used to tell Aaron. Blood or fire, you can come through that door. Otherwise, you see that sign? No. Because when you show up, my mommy brain kicks in. I can't even remember what I was thinking to write in this email. Like, it's gone.
Well, I was lucky too, because I could, you know, create a schedule that I could be home all day, right? So I worked at night. I was able to, my husband and I would do the high five so that he could come home, and then I would go to work so that he'd be home with the kids. But I left the phone in the car because, you know, people talk about wanting freedom, right? When they have a business, and there's no such thing. I mean, maybe if someone writes you a big check on your exit, you get freedom. But ultimately, when you're the leader at the helm, the buck stops with you. So I realized that if there's an emergency, you know, we had a 1-800 in our other business, which was like an emergency line. And so someone could always get in touch with me if it was an emergency. But it would take a lot for them to call a 1-800. And, you know, someone not paying a bill or having a conflict about a class or a costume that didn't fit is not an emergency. And so if you treat, you know, you teach people how to treat you, then they won't call you for the things. They'll figure it out. Or at least I would always say in the dance industry, like, this is not life and death ever. So there's nothing that can't wait. And I never gave, like, a client never had my personal cell phone, you know, 34 years later. My Miss Dance World of Dance could be, she was in China, she's dancing all over the world, and I would get a quick little email about her, you know, how amazing she did, and get the thank yous, but I wasn't getting like the texts. I didn't go to a lot of the extra things. I didn't live in the studio extra time, even when like a student really probably could have benefited from like my extra one-on-one time. I didn't. I just was very protective of my time. And I don't know how I ever would have created anything successful in my life if I didn't know from the beginning that everything had to work for me to be happy. And I could have had probably more successful dancers, maybe more world champions. But at the end of the day, that they landed where they needed to land it. And I was home, you know, with my kids when I wanted to be home.
Okay, so my final question is about trouble, because this is one of those stories that I was really made me think a little bit, you know, because so much of your story is, as you said, like it was pre-written, predestined, right? You had written it down. You had like to the month. That you're told.
Oh yeah. I mean, it's like almost embarrassing actually, because if you look back at a notebook that I had at 18, which I had for a long time, you know, I wrote June of 1994, like first child is born and my son was born. And then I wrote second baby comes 5 years later and my daughter was born on the same like summer. And I planned both the children in the summer because it's when the dance business is at its lowest, you know, and I had friends that like having all these infertility trouble. And it was like both times, you know, my poor husband like didn't get to have any fun, he'll always say, right? Because both times I was like, okay, this is a good month. And then 5 years later, I was like, this is a good month, you know, for more fun for him. So, I was very, very planned. I mean, exactly when businesses would open, exactly when the second business would open, exactly when we would hire this employee, exactly when we would do an expansion, exactly when I would buy my first business and build my first house and then build the second house and have this amount of money in the bank. I'm like so planned. And people would always say, well, be careful what you wish for. I was a telephone operator, had a job. I worked 8 to midnight as a telephone operator when I was in college. So I got up at 6 a.m. I did a daycare from 6 to 8. I did the early morning drop off for the daycare. Then I had class all day. I had rehearsals after classes. And then I worked 8 to midnight as a telephone operator. So I'd get home at like 1 a.m. and then be back up at 5:30 all through college. And I worked with a woman who was about in her late 70s, and I adored her. And it was my favorite thing about the job. And I would do my homework while I was there, which was also one thing I loved about the job because it wasn't that busy. So I could get a lot of my homework done and get paid my, you know, $1.80 an hour, or $2.25 an hour. I forget what minimum wage was at that time, something really painful. And she was just an amazing companion. And I would always feed so many ideas off of her. And she would get such a kick out of me because I was so planned and my whole life was planned. And she would always say, be careful what you wish for. You know, you make plans and God laughs. And I remember thinking like, yeah, I know. But, you know, I still got to, you know, I got to get these things done. And she would say, I know, but like, enjoy the journey, because maybe that would be the thing that most people would probably say about me is I didn't have fun in college. I didn't want to, and I don't look back and have any regrets because I just was working and very driven. And in my own life, I will choose work over fun because work for me is fun. So if someone had a criticism about me, they would probably say like, I don't enjoy the roses as much, which I'm trying to do as I get older now. But the idea that, you know, all these things were in line and I kept checking them off the box and checking them off the box and checking them off the box. And we built this big, now I grew up in a house, you know, with two bedrooms, and my brother and I shared a room till I was 12. And it had one, we had one tiny, tiny bathroom that didn't even lock. And here I built this big, and you know, an enormous house with like four bathrooms and five bedrooms and this big, huge pool in the backyard. And I was sitting there enjoying it and excited, but I just started getting like very fearful and just feeling very, very overwhelmed with fear because the last goal had been kind of checked off, which I didn't realize at the time. And kind of convincing myself, you know, that the bomb was just about ready to drop. And I think when you deal with a business that deals with women and women and children, and you see these perfectly healthy, happy, loving people come in with tragedy, you know, a child is sick or they've just been diagnosed with something. And there was a period of time where, you know, growing up, I didn't even know anyone that had cancer. And here I was, I felt like I was, you know, one or two people a year I was burying through the studio. And I kept thinking like, why am I going to be spared? I had a girlfriend that was going through a brittle divorce and she was so unhappy. And I looked at my husband like, I am the lucky. I just adore my husband. I adore my family and my kids. And it's not going to be sustained. You know, I'm not entitled. I haven't done enough to earn this. And so I just became absolutely overwhelmed with the fear of dying young, of leaving my kids, about, you know, just asking for so much, asking God, you know, just this one more project. Can I just do this one more thing? And then I promise no more. And when that house was built, it just something inside of me just panic mode. And I would just sit on the edge of my kids' beds, like weeping. And my husband, who saw me as so strong, you know, I was like such a strong woman to him. He'd always say, baby, you got to snap out of it. Like, you're so much stronger than that. And I couldn't, I just couldn't. I mean, it really, you know, I'm so grateful. One of the things I'm most grateful for is like the luxury of a sound mind, because people who wake up every day that have to, you know, fight those, the mind is so powerful and have to really fight is just such an unbelievable battle. As strong as I am, you know, I can't imagine that long term having to fight those kind of demons. And my primary care doctor, you know, he was very sweet, and I talked him into every kind of test you could do. I convinced him I had a brain tumor. I convinced him I had ovarian cancer. I convinced him I had lung cancer. And as much as I make light, you know, people do suffer with those things. So I don't talk about that too much, because in the moment, I really believed I had it. So when I talk about it now, and people like kind of laugh, you know, about it. But at the time, I was convinced. I thought I had Lou Gehrig's disease, and then I had MS. And it's like everything was terminal. So I would just ask God, I don't care what you give me. You can give me cancer. You can give me MS. You can give me any disease. Just don't make it terminal. Like, I'll live through it. I promise. I don't care. I won't see, you know, or if you're going to take away a sense, like take away my hearing, I want to be able to see my grandchildren. But I was constantly trying to make deals. And the primary care doctor, after 1 year, said like, you are banned. You cannot come anymore. You don't, none of these tests are positive and you are banned. And I left the office. I was like, well, I'll show you. And I hired a private physician. And it was $3,500 for the retainer. I remember writing the check like on the same day and just saying, can I get in today? And I remember his receptionist saying, no, it takes a little while. And it was like the longest 2 weeks waiting for that first appointment. basically anybody and everybody that I could talk to about my illnesses, I would ask their advice. I mean, if I had a freckle, it was skin cancer, and I would pull like a 17-year-old into the bathroom at like Dunkin' Donuts to say, like, do you see this freckle? Do you have a freckle like this on your body? And I mean, it was just like anybody and everybody. Have you ever had this headache? Do you see this hangnail? I mean, it was to the point of I thought I couldn't, I wasn't going to be able to kind of like sustain it. It was that bad. And on the first visit, the doctor was, you know, completely calm. And I was hysterically crying in the office. And I've cried twice my whole life. That was one time. And I couldn't like recover from crying. My poor husband, like, didn't, like I said, I've cried twice. So he didn't even know what to do with this. And he was rubbing my back, and the doctor asked for him to leave so we could talk. And he said, you know, is everything okay at home? I said, everything's okay. That's why I'm here. And he said, you know, tell me about your life. And I just started telling him. And then it came up about the businesses and these two beautiful children and my amazing husband. And I just built this house. And then he said, well, like, and then what's the next project? And I was like, oh, and he said, oh, I think you have a lot left to do. And he said, I want you to go home. I want you to make a list of what you want to do for the next 12 years, and I'll see you next year. And really, and then I went home and I just felt lighter. And I did write like some things I wanted to accomplish that week. And then that week became that month. And then that month became like the quarter. And then that quarter became a year. And then slowly but surely, like, I didn't die. And I know that people kind of make light of that too, but when a month went by and like I didn't die, and then 3 months went by and I was still here, and then 6 months, I started realizing, okay, I think I'm okay. I think I'm okay for now. But I still fight it, you know. I don't know why some people have such a tough road. You know, some of it's our choices, of course, but I have people that I'm super close to that, you know, by no fault of their own, they have just had a really, really tough road, whether they've lost a child or they've lost a spouse, or they've suffered with their own diseases, or been diagnosed young and not been able to live a long life and reap what they sow. I don't know. All I know is that as I've gotten older, I can't think about it. I can just do what I need to do. And I think that's why, another reason why I'm really, really driven, even though I'm much older, I'm still just as driven, because I just want to get everything in. I don't want the time. I don't want to be on my deathbed saying, like, I really missed that opportunity. I'm just very opportunity driven.
Yeah. It was such a powerful story to think about how, you know, the that piece of sustained success that you talk about in the book, that, you know, so much of the conversation in the industry is around just achieving success without really thinking about what happens after you do that. How do you sustain it? Do you have the belief that once you get it, it's going to be taken away? You know, because I've seen that. The shoe drop thing. I experienced it the first few years in my own business. I'd surpass a threshold, and I'd hit some sort of like pinnacle moment, and then boom, there something would go. And it was, I had to sit with it for a few years and sort out, what is it in there that makes me think that I can't have that, or that when I get it, I gotta have it disappear. And so I loved, I'm sorry you went through that. And the fact that you shared it in the story, I think, is going to help so many people to plan beyond their goals, you know, to plan beyond the checklist, their current checklist.
Right. And I think too, for me, like, I just was never motivated by the big award, right? By the big trophy, especially in a business that we have a lot of accolades and we have a lot of like award shows and getting the award, like, they, you know, it's nice, but it was never what I worked for. And so for sustaining success, it's easy because it's not about that pinnacle for me. It's about the next pinnacle. It's always about the next pinnacle. It's always about the next thing down the road, and about really honoring and earning every day the relationships that have helped me get to where I am. So I, from a young age, I mean, my parents, I thought, you know, we're going to sustain a marriage forever. And when they didn't, it was absolutely devastating. It was devastating to my brother and I and my mom. My mother, you know, still hasn't recovered. It's like been 30 years. And I didn't want that for myself. And I was bound and determined to wake up every day and be really, really happily married. And do whatever I needed to do to sustain that, because I could not be half the person I was if I didn't have somebody that was kind of walking, you know, shoulder to shoulder with me. And he has been absolutely the biggest support system, and nobody else on the whole planet like loves my two kids the way I do, but him, like one person in the whole world that feels like their pain and their joy like me. And I didn't want to share that. I wanted to share that with someone. You know, he softens if one of my kids is having a bad day, then he softens that for me, right? Because I can share that. And if one of them has the most amazing day, it's even better because I'm sharing that with someone. So I didn't want to go through this life by myself. And I wanted to earn every bit of that relationship. And I think it's so easy, no matter what we're doing, for our work life or our home life or even with friends, to get really complacent in the relationships that we feel like are there that are always going to support us. But the reality is that on any given day, you know, those relationships can be gone. So I didn't want 1 minute to go by that the people in my life didn't realize like how important they were. So when I say success, sustaining success, it really is for me this idea that, you know, whoever I was yesterday is already gone. So it doesn't matter. So who am I going to show up to be today? And tomorrow is the only thing that I can control.
Mm. Oh, good. I can't wait to hear all the reviews on this book. But we have two of your readers here. So I wonder if they've got any final burning questions or thoughts about the book.
I loved the one on love and loyalty, and you're talking about being intentional about your relationship. I was like, just chills. So powerful. I do have a question though. Another very powerful moment in the book for me, is when you talked about the harmony versus balance, and you likened it to the dance and where your weight was and it was constant movement. It was such a beautiful picture for me, and I was like, I want to hold on to that. I need that, and I'm a practical application person, and so I was trying to like, how would that look in my life? And if you could just give a little picture of how that works so I can create my own picture.
Sure.
That'd be great.
No, I would love to. So again, as an 18, 19 year old and going to the library and renting these cassette tapes for, you know, mentors and life skills people and people who talked about business, it was always this idea, you know, that you had to balance life and that there was this idea that you could actually work-life balance, right? Or have freedom in your business. And as soon as I got into the business, I realized right away, like, that's a crock of crap. Like, there's no such thing as work-life balance, and there's no such thing as freedom in a business. So I was actually kind of, it frustrated me because I think when people aren't balancing, they feel like they're doing something wrong, right? So balance to me means like, I think of balance like we're supposed to keep things even, right? Like here's the teeter-totter and I put something here and I put something here. But if I give you a pencil and an elephant and ask you to balance it, like how can you, right? You say it's not possible. So my balance versus my husband versus my business versus my kids versus my mother versus my brother versus my best friend who's going through a hard time. How am I supposed to balance things that in any given time don't weigh the same? So for me, I said, I can't think of my life in terms of balance, but I have to take all the pieces of my life that mean so much to me. And I have to think of how I put them together where they'll make sense in my life, where they all work together. So that's why I call it harmony, because I love music and I love classical music, and I love when the violin plays, and then I love when the harp comes in, and then the piano has its introduction. And I thought, that's what I want my life to be. Not that we have to balance everything, but that at any given moment, everything has its opportunity to kind of shine. And some days I missed family things. Absolutely. Like, I never went to a parent conference meeting because I worked every single Thursday night for 30 years. But my husband went to all the parent conference meetings. So I never felt like I was missing out, or I was trying to balance my life on a Thursday with my home life and my work life. Thursdays, I went to work every single Thursday. If my son had a playoff baseball game, I went to work. If my daughter had a concert at school, I went to work, and my husband went to all those things. I wasn't balancing. But on Fridays and on Wednesdays, when I had my day off, I went to all the concerts. I went to those parent conference meetings, and I wasn't at work. So for me, I say harmony because every single piece of my life, I put together in a way where they would support each other and work together so that they weren't fighting each other. And I was never in the middle trying to decide if I'm over here, I'm letting this one down, or if I'm over here, I'm letting this one down. I mean, every Wednesday night we had date night. And we've had it for 40 years, and my kids didn't come. And we had that time together, just him and I, every Wednesday night was date night. And I didn't feel like I was letting my children down, right, by not having time with them, because I had my days with them, and I had my days that I was at work, and I had my days that I was traveling at work, and I had my days when I didn't pick up the phone. So why I call it harmony is because I think we can develop harmony as women who have children, who have spouses, who have businesses, who are hungry. But I don't believe that we can balance things that don't ever weigh the same.
There we go. Thank you. Thank you.
That was a beautiful explanation. I love that. I thought I knew what you were talking about, but wow, that just really solidified it for me. You and I met at one of Amanda's retreats, and I saw you fly in and go up to your room and work, and then come down and grab something to eat, and you were this consistent. I mean, like, that's the only way I know you. I mean, like, she's a go-getter. She's busy. This is what she's working on. She's here to do her book. This is what's getting done. So I love that about you, but I didn't ever feel like I really got to know you. And I missed that, but you were focused, and I totally respected that. However, when I started reading your book, and you started in with the whole not everyone deserves a trophy, I went, oh, this is my girl. I can get on board with her. And there were just so many things. My husband and I own four businesses, three now, but we've owned four in the past, all 6 and 7 figure income, and have had some of those similar frustrations and, you know, challenges and such. And so there were a lot of things that you and I really agreed on. And we really, you know, I'm like, yes, yes, I'm so glad she's saying it this way. I'm so glad she's doing it this way. Then we came to the employees. And I was like, that is an area where I have struggled hiring a person and thinking they're this person, but they're not. And you talked about someone you called Polly. And that she had the perfect resume, she had the perfect this, the perfect that, but didn't end up being the perfect person, you know, for the job. And I would like it if you could explain a little bit more about that process that you go through. Because I know if they say hell yes, then you work with them, right? I mean, like, that's your determining factor. If they answer your question, are you committed to excellence? And they say hell yes, then it's a go. But could you give me a little more information on because that's not enough for me.
Sure. So it goes back a little bit to when I said that, you know, I get paid a lot of money to teach people, right, how to dance. So if they come in, they already have to have the skill set. So just because somebody is highly skilled in something, right, doesn't mean that they're going to be the best fit. And so I think that's what you're talking to, is that how do you know in a short amount of time when somebody comes in, are they going to be the right, you know, cultural fit? Are they going to really have the skills? Are they going to really be able to help you propel or build your culture, build your company? And the reality is, I don't think you do know right away. And so nobody gets the reins in my business until there's kind of a really long onboarding. Now they work under somebody for quite a bit of time and we learn about them, because again, they can say it's a hell yes, right? They can say I'm absolutely committed to excellence, but their actions will show soon enough whether they are in fact or not. So for me, just because someone maybe is crazy talented doesn't mean that they will be able to explain like their system, that they'll be able to follow like protocol, that they'll be able to really inspire a classroom of students, that they'll show up on time, that they'll have creative ideas, that they'll be a strong team player. So I need to be with them, sit with them for a while. The whole company needs to sit with them, kind of get a feel for like what kind of person they are and do we genuinely like you? Because at the end of the day, I want to be surrounded by people I like. And I want to be surrounded by people that will inspire me and challenge me to do better. So I liken our entire system. And when we bring an employee in, it's really in that team feeling. I never played a sport in my whole life, but yet I think I was an NFL football coach in another life, because I am obsessed with like this whole professional team kind of mantra. And I love the idea of Nick Saban, who's like a big coach, he says, it's not about putting people on the bus, it's about putting people in the right seats on the bus. And I think that was like a huge aha moment for me when I was first starting to hire employees. So it's not about whether they have the high skill set. It's that, you know, if you're looking for a receiver, are they the best receiver for the job? Because if they're a linebacker, they might be incredible at that. But my position that I'm trying to fill is for a receiver. So seeing how all the people kind of play in together. So Polly was, again, an amazing, amazing artist. And she had a ton of talents and she had a beautiful resume. But she didn't know how to explain that to other children. And she wasn't really dedicated to the children like I wanted her to be. She was still more of an artist than a teacher. So just because you are skilled doesn't mean that you're ready to kind of give up the performing side, because I was looking for artists who could then become mentors. So having that criteria when I bring someone in, taking the time to really sit with them and talk to them, asking them why they want to work for me is a big one. Like why choose my company? And then I ask them to sit home after 2 days and send me an email to let me know again, why. And all the dance studios in the entire state of Massachusetts, why would you want to work for mine? And see that it's not just about teaching dance, but about teaching dance in my space or in another business that we have. What brings you here today? Because if it's just about the paycheck for any of our businesses, you're probably not going to be the right fit. For that reason, I like to overpay. I want to overpay the position. I would rather have one star employee than four mediocre ones. So sometimes I can get people in the door because they've heard of like what a great position it is. And so it's even more important that I really kind of weed out the people that are in there just for the paycheck. So nobody has a starting date at any business that I own without a 3-month trial. So they come in, I pay them for the 3-month trial. I pay them very, very well. And after the 3 months, I decide whether they're the right fit or not.
Well, that's another area where you and I agree on, because I do a 90-day, you know, let's try this out, see how it works, see if we work well together. But here's the kicker for me that makes it a little bit different than yours, is that we have very few employees. So there's not really a large team to have them integrate with and such. So there, I took away a lot from what you just said, and I really appreciate that. But is there anything else where you would say, with such a small team, you would do anything different besides that 90 day? And I'm all about let's do the 90 days, see how that works. Feel free to leave if this doesn't work for you. And I'm going to feel free to say, this isn't working for me. And, you know, and I'm sorry, but
yeah,
that honesty, so, that integrity, I agree.
So, so I've never let any, actually never let anyone go after that 3 months. I still kind of keep them under the radar usually, but they might decide after 3 months. It's more for them to decide, because I won't let them in the door unless they have like the skill set and everything ready to go. But after that 3 months, they might feel like this is just not the right fit for me, which is fine. So that's also nice, because I really like overload them to the point where I don't want to make the decision that this isn't the right fit for you. I really want to see like what kind of character do you have here under like trying circumstances. But it started off really slow. So, you know, I have 30 employees in the dance business, and altogether, I think in all of our companies, we have like 125. So we don't have like hundreds and hundreds of employees, but it all is under the same kind of umbrella where we bring them in and we really kind of engross them in the culture. And I am just so transparent. There's nothing that a new employee can't answer, ask me that I won't answer. You want to know how many students I have. You want to know what our monthly intake. I mean, you can ask me kind of anything and I'm happy to share it, because I want the absolute best candidate for my business. And I'm not shy to say it. And I'm also not shy to say, like, I'm going to really have the biggest expectations that you're going to really be like, I don't know if this is the right place for me. And that's totally okay. But if that's a challenge for you and you're excited to work for someone that's going to give you like all these resources to really be the best absolute educator you can be, work with the most amazing kids that you could work, and have all this freedom to really be creative and work with just an amazing team of people, that I'd love to have you. But if we're not the right fit, like, that's okay. So there's zero pressure for them. And I think that also weeds out, because when you give people not a lot of pressure, believe it or not, when you don't give them this, like, you have to show up at 8, you have to be here by 8:10, this is what you have to wear, it's a lot harder for people to be kind of held accountable to their own. So you can kind of really see from the beginning, when I say you need to write me like in 2 days, you see like who doesn't get that done, right? Then right away, they're not the right fit. Why do you want to work here? And they don't have the answer. They haven't really followed through on why are they even showing up at the door. So I look for people that are really, really prepared and are really hungry for opportunity and the next opportunity. So we have 30 now, and it's like, you know, the big dog is teaching the little puppies with the little nip on the back. Like, this is how we do things here. But in the beginning, when it was just me, you know, fish rot from the head down, right? So I did exactly what the expectation was every single time. So they just learned, like, this is what's expected. You know, I never called it in. I never miss class. I'm never late. I never don't show up for an appointment. I never miss a meeting. I talk to everybody very kind, the way I would want someone to speak to me. I don't dismiss anyone. I don't think of people as subordinates. I do think I work for my employees like I work for my parents. My job is to make their job as easy as possible so that they can be the most successful, because I really do appreciate the people that are helping me, you know, open value and opportunity to the community. So I talk to them like I would talk to like a best friend, and they know right away, like, I absolutely want to work for this woman, or get me the hell out of here.
You know what? I
love that.
I just had this image of Lori Gacy is a high adventure junkie. And so I just thought, basically what she just said in high adventure language is put together an obstacle course and then run ahead of them and see if they can keep up with you.
It's basically show them how to do it, right? Yeah. If I can do this, you know, but it's kind of like me telling Shaylee last weekend, if you don't stop this, I'm going to run up the hill and, and you're going to have to follow me.
I just saw you literally thinking about that whole process, like an obstacle course, and it made me get it.
That was great. I love that. And I there's so many things that you and I, like, I do a lot of those things. So that was great, because it was confirmation doing it right, you know.
Well, yeah, and I don't think there's any right or wrong, right? Of course, there's no right or wrong. I'm just, that's what works for me. Like, I don't have a non-compete, right? So I'm the only dance studio I know in the country that doesn't have a non-compete, because I tell them, you think you can open up next door, sweetheart? You go right at it. It will just make me that much better at what I do. So I think there's just like a level of confidence that I have that I don't even, that can maybe come off as arrogance, which I don't mean it to be, but it's just that I'm very convicted in what I believe in. And if you have the same convictions and you want to be part of it, then we will do amazing things together. But if it's not for you, like, I absolutely would love for you to know that sooner than later, so that we're just not wasting anybody's time. So there's three interviews and I talk to them like I'm talking to you guys right now. I mean, just like really lay it all out what is expected, and that you will do great things here, but you will also go home sometimes with a stomach ache, like, crap, I didn't pull my own weight today. And if that doesn't get you up at night at 2 a.m, like, how can I be better? Then this is not the right fit for you. Because we all wake up at 2 a.m. with stomach ache. Mm-hmm. 34 years later.
I agree. Yeah. Well, thank you so much. And it was a privilege to be able to read your book and to give you some feedback. And I love it. I can't wait to see everybody else's response.
Yeah. So, Stephanie, the book is coming out June 22nd.
Or June 20th, I think.
June 20th?
I think so, yeah.
Okay. So what's next for you?
So I'm starting a new business. I am franchising New England Dance Academy. So I've been in the last 6 months of all the legal paperwork. We just did, you know, the 200-page FDD, and there's 150-page operations manual that we're finishing. It is legal on the 1st, and on the 11th, I have a huge show that my kids are in that I'm producing with 5,000 attendees, and I am launching... And I'm launching that franchise at that event.
Wow. So exciting. Well, if people want to know more about you, see your dancers, learn more about the book, where do you want them to go to find out more?
Right now, I would think there's two spots. They can go to www.newenglanddanceacademy.com, or they can go to stephaniepkemp.com. If they want to learn more about the book and kind of the business side, then the personal web page is a little bit more intimate. And if they want to learn more about the business, that would be newenglanddanceacademy.com.
Excellent. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you, everybody. Thank you.
Thank you for the opportunity to run alongside you as you worked on this. And
thank you.
I can't wait to celebrate with you when it's launched and the next business is thriving. So thank you. And thank you to all of our listeners and viewers. If you like what you heard, please consider subscribing or sharing. And with that, I think this is a wrap.
Thank you.
Thank you.